You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we like what you don't, but not in a hipster kind of way. We just do, because, like Dr. Awkward, we're just a little bit different. I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I'm really excited for this episode. It's the first in our Snyder series, an in-depth look at the works of my favorite director, Zack Snyder. I first heard about Snyder way back in, I believe it was 2005. I probably should know this if I'm doing a Snyder series. It's whenever 300 was released. And if all of you were on social media at the time, you'll remember that MySpace got branded and painted and wallpapered with art for 300. So I saw all that art and I was like, I'm never going to see this movie. This is just a big budget studio hack fest that's going to be awful. And then for some reason I actually did see it and I was blown away. And my life has changed ever since. No, it hasn't been quite that extreme, but I just had a different emotional reaction to that movie than I think I ever had in my entire life. Joining me today, via Skype, live from Austin, Texas, Daniel T. Richards. How are you, Daniel?
Oh, you know, it's a great day. Any day you can talk about Zack Snyder, well, that's a day right there.
You're going a little too hipster with the way you're talking right now. I'm not sure I appreciate that.
I live in Austin.
It's rubbing off on you?
I can't help it. I live in Austin and I have a beard. I can't do anything about it. It just infects me.
All right. So we heard a little bit about, you know, me seeing 300 for the first time. What's your Snyder story?
So similarly, the first Zack Snyder film that I saw was 300, except that that was at a time when I wasn't paying particular attention to, let's say, writers and directors per se. I was paying much more attention to storyline and plot, theme, etc. And so I didn't even recognize it as a, you know, quote, Snyder film. I saw it, loved it, thought it was a masterpiece. And so I guess my first real awareness of Zack Snyder as a director was when there was a big deal made about him directing Watchmen. And I started making the connection like, oh, I guess he was the guy who directed 300. This might be a good adaptation of Watchmen. I'd read the comic. I guess I was in grad school. 2008, 7? Yeah. I don't do fact checking. So
You're really
I went
prepared for this.
It's so funny that we actually are kind of insanely prepared, except for, you know, our own lives. So I saw Watchmen, was completely blown away, and then the ending comes, and spoiler alert for anyone, it's different from the graphic novel, and my head exploded because it was an awesome choice of ending. And that's when I said, this Zack Snyder guy, he is the future.
It's interesting you say that because I didn't read Watchmen until I heard the movie was coming out and he was directing it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting that we have sort of the reverse thing going on there, where because I'm aware of writer-directors. Because I do think that that is the sort of time period where he transitioned in the mainstream.
Yeah.
To a more sort of legitimate writer-director who you know by name versus just somebody who made a couple of movies.
Right. He was no Mick G at the time.
Is anyone a Mick G? Is Mick G a Mick G?
He's a Mick... Fuck that guy.
Also joining me, across the table, live from Irvine, California, Hannah Labiga. How are you, Hannah?
Hello. I am well, thank you.
Remember, lean into the microphone.
I'm trying to, but that makes us almost make out, and it's weird.
Because that's never happened before. All right, what's your Snyder story, Hannah?
The first time, I didn't even know who Zack Snyder was. I saw an amazing zombie movie, Dawn of the Dead, which was so moving that opening weekend, all my siblings saw it, and we all called each other and said, we needed a zombie disaster plan, like, now. This could happen. That's how good that movie was. It just, like, shook us to our core, and we're like, this could happen. And now apparently the CDC has a disaster preparedness plan for zombies in case of a zombie apocalypse.
It's interesting you tell that story. I didn't realize that your obsession with zombie apocalypse plans was due to Zack Snyder. And I think that lines up with something we'll talk about in our Yahoo Answers Answer segment, where people compare Dawn of the Dead to other zombie films. So I think we'll get into that a little bit later. That's interesting, sort of more of a mainstream perspective, because I don't think my perspective of paying attention to writers and directors is very the norm, we'll say.
Yeah, and I've apparently seen all Zack Snyder's films, and when I met you, you said, well, those are all his films. I'm like, oh, okay. Thanks for tying that up for me.
That's what I do. I integrate things when people didn't realize they were integrated. All right, since this is the beginning of the Snyder series, I think we should learn a little bit about his life to understand his approach as a filmmaker before we delve into his movies. Because, of course, we're going to talk about Dawn of the Dead today. Make sense? Good.
Ooh.
Let's do it.
Can you see my dear? What you create is greater than great. It's beautiful and valid. Go tell the false friend who doubts your life. Hey, toss my caustic salad. Their noise pollution is a one-night stand. A closet corporate ballad. Compose the fiend. Compose the fiend that sees a heart.
If you look in the podcast post down there, you'll see that I have a whole document that I've put in the post about who he is and all the research we've done on his life. Let's start in the right place to start with anyone, in the beginning of his life. So I think the crazy thing that stuck out to me about the beginning of his life is the same thing that sticks out to me about a lot of people who are, you know, extremely successful in their fields, is how they know from such a young age what they want to do. And with Snyder, we have him. He wanted to be an animator at age 11. And then when Star Wars came out, and I have to begrudgingly respect Star Wars now, it inspired him to become a director. So
What's that? Without Star Wars, we have Zack Snyder? What's that?
That's correct. Without Star Wars, we would not have Zack Snyder.
Now,
I would like to note that it also gave us Damon Lindelof, but I guess you got to take the bad with the good.
I think Snyder crushes Lindelof in terms of goodness versus badness, but we'll see.
Right.
In the long run.
So, you know, Snyder was born in 66, and then at 11 he wanted to be an animator, and then Star Wars came out that same year. And I think there's a lot of crossover between Star Wars and animation and, you know, puppeteering. So you can see why somebody who wanted to do that would immediately turn to film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's very much... It's for as much as you don't like Star Wars, the whole thing had a really good integration of sort of animation with puppetry and sort of seamlessly tried to put these, the CGI together, that's what I'm trying to say, without making it blatantly obvious. And I think that was just historically in film was a big step forward for film. And young Zack Snyder, I'm sure, went, holy crap, I want to do that.
Especially with the way we see he uses special effects and visual style.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I've never said bad things about Star Wars in relation to its visual effects and its, you know, its directing. I think in that sense it's good. I just have problems with the writing of it.
Okay, tangent. Okay.
Well, no, I mean, I think it's an important tangent because of how it, you know, influenced Snyder. But moving on with the rest of Snyder's life, so, you know, then obviously he grew up, and I think it's important to look at where he went to high school because... He went to a small private boarding school in California. And when I say, not California, in Connecticut, sorry. Greenwich, Connecticut, which immediately we're going to know people aren't going to like him for what reason, Dan? You'll...
Because he's from the Northeast?
Well, and Greenwich is, maybe you don't know this, but Greenwich is known as like a rich town. So,
oh, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I've like, never been to Connecticut.
Oh, yeah, that's where like a lot of the rich yuppies live. So people are going to say, oh, well, of course he comes from the rich background. And he went to the small school. There was 130 enrollment for 9th grade through 12th grade. And it's a private Christian Science boarding school. So that's really interesting.
Oh.
I didn't really think he came from a Christian Science background, right?
Hence the sci-fi.
Right.
Hence the sci-fi.
That's funny. That's actually a smaller high school than my high school. And I thought mine was the tiniest ever.
Yeah, my school was a small, wasn't boarding, but it was a private school in New England, Massachusetts, K through 12, and it was 500. So I thought mine was small. I mean, 60 kids per class in high school. So his was about half the size of my high school, and I thought mine was small. So, but it, I mean, it is interesting, and you know, I'm going to read a quote from here in a second, but I can corroborate that. When it is so small, you do have more of an opportunity to sort of be yourself. And this is the quote he has. "It wasn't that clicky at Daycroft." Daycroft was the name of his school. "There was only like 100 of us. It was more incestuous than it was clicky. That was the problem. Weird but true. There was a freedom for you to be yourself. There were a lot of characters in that group. I think it was because they were allowed to be. At school, at Daycroft, I had the same kind of personality then. I don't think I've changed that much. Other than that, I'm a little bit smarter, maybe." Well, I think he's a lot bit smarter. Mm-hmm. But we see how sort of he's not afraid in his movies to be himself. And we can see how that was laid from the fact that he was younger.
He's probably taller, too, just to be fair.
Maybe a little bit taller. And I think he has more tattoos now, right?
Yeah. Also more married than he was then.
And he's a baller.
Yeah, a lot more money.
Well, that's true. And he has 6 kids or something. But yeah. Imagine if he actually had a Deborah tattoo from the time he was young and then he met her. He's like, whoa.
It's a birthmark. Look at that.
So there is another quote that I want to read from him talking about his high school. And I think this is really important to understand about him, too. It says, "I'm at this real strict boarding school with my parents there, and my mother more than my father, of course, happened to let me break the rules and get away with stuff. In some way, I would bend that world to my will, in a really manipulative and horrible way, because I was in high school. I mean, I feel bad about it a little bit, but on the other hand, it gave me a way I'd approach life. The same thing, I bend the rules of society a little bit, and I've chosen a lifestyle that's outside of the normal approach to how I would make a living. My mother and father and sister, they were pretty supportive of me. They knew that I was not the sharpest tool in the shed, that I was a bit of a dreamer, and, you know, I think having them pull up the slack for me as far as what was expected of me from the rules aspect of high school, they let me get away with things. I would have had a really hard time without them."
Interesting.
You know, besides the fact that he comes from a loving family, I think the idea that he bends the rules and he doesn't do what's normal and he just kind of does whatever the fuck he wants, I think that's pretty consistent with his filmmaking style, where he's not afraid to just do whatever he wants and what he thinks is best. Forget the rules of filmmaking and forget what people say are good and bad.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. He is not afraid to take on heavy criticism for doing things that aren't, I don't know. I guess the mainstream view of it is basically he doesn't do things that are dark enough. I don't know, but I'm glad to see that this was something he adopted at an early age and not something he was doing by mistake.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's not just that it's dark enough. They're saying it's all visual style and not substance, which, I mean, we'll find out over the course of the series that's not true at all. But it's the reason people don't see the substance is because he approaches the substance differently. And we'll understand that in a second here. But before we move on to his philosophy, after he graduated from high school, which was a big influential time in film because it was the early 80s. He went to London's prestigious Heatherley School of Fine Art, and then he attended the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena with Michael Bay.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that was kind of interesting because you couldn't see similarities in their styles.
I think it's really, I want to picture them like going out in the town together. Like picking up chicks at the same time.
Like, wouldn't this be really cool if it exploded?
Exactly. I think that'd be like a funny sitcom.
Yeah, that actually would have been cool to do in The Neighbors because they had Michael Bay in The Neighbors one episode. So then they could have brought him back with Zack Snyder. That would have been really funny.
Yeah, that'd have been awesome.
All right. So, and then the big thing, right, is what was he doing before he directed film? So he went to high school in Connecticut. Then he went to these schools in London and Pasadena. Then he was a big-time commercial and music video director. And once again, if you look down in the post, I've gathered a lot of those to sort of show people what he was doing. And we watched all of those. What were your impressions, Daniel and Hannah, of all the music videos and the commercials?
I'll let Hannah go first, to be polite.
They were interesting. I watched a few of them, and one of them is actually in Dawn of the Dead, but they were rather creative and not the norm of what you'd expect from a usual commercial.
Yeah, so the music videos are a little bit harder for me than the commercials. Music videos, I don't know, the entire genre to me is just like, what is being accomplished with this, really? But I can speak more to the commercials. The commercials, I thought, were some of the better commercials I've seen, and not just because they're directed by Zack Snyder.
Well, but this is backed up by the Cleos, right? He was nominated for a bunch of Cleos, and he won a couple. So, yeah. I mean, it's not just us saying he had the best commercials. It's the Cleos, which are the awards for advertising, which we've seen Don Draper win a bunch of. So, yes, Zack Snyder exactly. is Don Draper.
Basically. Less scotch or whatever. What was I saying? Completely.
You said they were some of the best commercials you've seen?
Yes, because they're not gimmick commercials. Not a single one of them is a gimmick commercial. The commercials are stories, and they're told with a clear beginning, middle, and end. Especially the one that I liked, although I didn't particularly like the message of it per se, but that I liked the story was the BMW commercial with the lingerie. Mm-hmm. Anyone? Bueller?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Because there was like a setup and there was a twist and then there was like this ending and you're like, oh, holy crap, that's hilarious. And then there was another twist. And it was just like a story. It was a self-contained 1 minute story. And that's, and even the, like he did a bunch of Budweiser commercials, with the Clydesdales horses in one of them, and those all told stories, and I really appreciate that about the commercials.
Yeah, one of the things I was really surprised about continually when doing this research is the way sort of, even before I was aware of Zack Snyder, I was aware of Zack Snyder, and the Clydesdale commercial you're talking about is during the Super Bowl, he did a couple for one in 2002 and one in 2003. So 2 years in a row, he did Budweiser Clydesdale commercials. And one of them was the post 9/11 one that only aired once. And I remember that Super Bowl, not just because that's when the Patriots won their first Super Bowl. Woo! But I just remember seeing that commercial and just how emotionally powerful that was following 9/11 to, you know, the way he paced that. Because I'm sure they just gave him the concept and said, okay, execute that. So the way he paced it and, you know, it slowly establishes the Clydesdales coming out of their barn and then walking to the field where they bow down to New York City to pay homage to what happened and to show their respect. That, I mean, that commercial is like a commercial I'll always remember. And the fact that he actually directed that, I was like, wow, that's really neat that he was even impacting me emotionally, visually back then.
Yeah, absolutely. No words in that commercial either.
Yeah, which is another thing. I mean, and that's the thing, if we're going to talk about his commercials and his music videos as a whole, yeah, the story thing I think is really important. But I think that you can see the beginnings of his style. With the music videos, what I really noticed is the color saturation. So in all of them, he always tried to do something with the color. So when you look at like the Morrissey music video, it's all black and white and it's just one long shot. And a lot of them similarly have different saturations with, you know, there's blue or green or brown. And we see that that's something he's done majorly, especially since 300. Also with the music videos, and this is something I don't see enough of in music videos, and I was really, you know, impressed that he did this. And once again, it continues in his movies, is the way he actually lined up his visuals and the cuts with the music itself.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really see that where like there'll be a big beat and like a bunch of stuff will happen visually. So you can see he's thinking of things holistically.
Right.
And
although that Michael Jordan one, just no.
Well, that was his first, right? That was 1990, right?
Right, but I just had to mention that Michael Jordan dancing just was a terrible, terrible idea. I'm sure, but it probably wasn't his idea. But
right. But even in that, in the highlights, what color were the Michael Jordan highlights? They were blue. So even in that one, you saw him using the color saturation to show it's different than reality.
Right.
So it's interesting, even back then he was doing that. And then with the commercials, I think the one that really stood out to me, besides the one we just talked about, Budweiser, did you remember the EB Beer Generals party?
Oh yeah, absolutely. it's so funny because I the first thing I thought was, this is what he did in Watchmen in the beginning, actually, with the whole setup of the photography stuff. Anyway, but go ahead.
Well, you're right. It's very, very similar, and it's sort of that satirical edge where he's doing the same thing, and he probably intentionally did that. But again, this is his use of music, right? He's really known for the way he uses music in his films and the way he has mm-hmm. this sort of very ironic edge, he would call it.
Mm-hmm.
And that commercial was actually banned from TV, so it could only be shown in theaters.
Interesting.
Because it was anti-communist and socialist, right? Because it was a Polish beer. And it's actually very funny if you know the history of Poland, which I studied a little bit because I'm Polish. So I thought it was a very good all-around commercial, and it really demonstrated who he is as a filmmaker. So do we have any final comments on these videos and commercials?
Last thing I want to say is that he did a little special thing for the 75th anniversary of Superman, mm-hmm. which sort of integrated all the different versions of Superman into one kind of story, which I actually thought was impressive as well.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the Man of Steel podcast.
Yeah.
Because that kind of goes hand in hand with that. So let's talk a little bit now. We've talked about some of his early work. So let's talk a little bit about his philosophy and sort of the way he approaches filmmaking to sort of get a better understanding before we actually talk about one of his films. So I've broken it down into a few different categories here. And the different categories are self-reliance, his job, his influences, his definition of success, and romanticism in film. And we're going to build towards romanticism because that's the biggest and most important one here, right?
Yep.
But let's talk about the self-reliance a little bit, because I think that's really interesting in light of movie making is considered such a collaborative process, right? But something we've seen over and over again is in order for the collaboration to work is you need that really strong person in the front who knows what he's doing, right? When you have a Mad Men, you have a Matthew Weiner who's really in charge, or you have a great director like Christopher Nolan, who we're going to talk about a little bit later, they really steer the ship. And I think Snyder's that way too. And we see this in, this was an interview with him and his wife with the New York Times where they've said he's been known to lack a certain assertiveness. When someone he and his wife have hired fails to live up to their expectations, he avoids the confrontation and does the work himself. This is his quote. "It can be doing anything. It could be a bad gardener and he's not mowing the grass that great. I'll just mow it myself." And I just think that's pretty crazy to think of a big time Hollywood director who, you know, he just does it himself and wants it done the best way possible. And he takes care of it and he's not too, you know, his ego is not too big in the stereotypical sense that he's like, well, fuck that. I'm not going to mow the lawn.
Yeah, that's very cool. Cause I would not mow the lawn. I don't mow the lawn now. If I have to, I'll make anything. So
you really are in Austin, huh?
Yeah, we don't mow the lawn. We hire Mexicans for that.
Yeah. And no, I can just see that, you know, switching over. Like if the cinematographer is having an issue because, you know, Zack Snyder was the DP for director of photography for a lot of his commercials and music videos. I could see him being like, oh, I'll take care of that. Or if the gaffer or the sound guy or any of these people are having trouble, I could see him just being like, oh, I'll help you with that. I'll do that just to get it done as quickly as possible. Where a lot of directors just sit there and let everyone else deal with it, right?
Yeah, there's a couple of things here that I think point to his success and that you can find in other successful people, which is one is sort of a close attention to detail, and we'll get into more of that in his philosophy of his job in a bit. But then the second one is a knowledge of all of the things required to do something well. So you can sort of be successful in one area of your life by knowing one thing. Or you can be successful by having a complete, total understanding of many of the variety of things that had to be done, say, for filmmaking. And I think that's where Zack Snyder really stands out as a director.
Yeah, and you can definitely tell his passion for it because it envelops him. It defines him, like, all that passion and being able to know what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that way I don't think we can understate the influence or the importance of him being his own DP for commercials and music videos. I think that had a huge influence on his success in the long run. I think it really needs to be driven home, which is why I'm driving it home. So I'm going to read a couple quotes here about his job. So the first one, "I always say, thank God I have this job or I don't know what I'd be doing. It'd be sad. I've always felt like I've been trying to brand a world for quite a long time. You know what, though? I feel no different. I feel like I'm doing the exact same thing I did in high school, only I have more people helping me out now. This, Daniel, goes to what you were just saying about being able to do all of it. So he's been doing all of it since high school. It's just more people are helping him. And it goes to what you were saying, Hannah, about it enveloping him. It's enveloped him his whole life. He's trying to create a whole world. He's not just like, oh, I'm going to make a movie. He's bringing a whole world to life. In the other quote, it's weird I have a job and I've had a job since out of college that doesn't require me to edit my personality that much. It's your thing. It's insular and whatever you do, you do. It's crazy and I get yelled at sometimes by people in a restaurant for being too loud because I just don't realize it. It's like you can't do that. It's actually funny because we were out last night and I was getting kind of loud talking about like Walking Dead and Game of Thrones and Doctor Who. And I just remembered that quote. I was just kind of laughing to myself.
There are definitely certain people whose passions sort of overshadow this need for societal approval or whatever it is. And I mean, I've seen them and I try not to yell at those people in restaurants, although I will if they're really that loud while I'm enjoying my steak. But it's interesting. The people are rare in life, definitely. So I'm not surprised that Zack Snyder is one of them.
Right. So here, let's talk about his influences a little bit. You know, I said the 80s to, you know, 1980, 84, early 80s were big for him. This is what he had to say. Blade Runner, fucking Road Warrior, Conan, these movies really stood out to me as movies that have shaped me. Return of the Jedi, heavy metal, all that stuff. It's funny how you get shaped more than actually than when you're in film school trying to be all intellectual. And there's nothing you can do to change that. I aim my movies as much as I can at myself.
How dare he?
So there's a couple of things here, right? The first is we can see where a lot of his visual style comes from, right? We already talked about Star Wars and that influence on him. But how about heavy metal? I've never actually seen it. I've only seen the South Park version of it. But seeing the way the South Park version is, I can see why he would have gotten a lot of influence from heavy metal.
Yeah, it's very romantic in the sense that it doesn't, it's accentuated parts of reality.
Hannah, you said you've seen
an accentuated.
Right?
Yeah.
Someone just put it on during a party, so I don't remember most of it.
That probably happens to a lot of Snyder films too. So, and then the other thing is, Daniel, what you were saying about how dare he. It's really interesting that he goes from his influences to talking about he aims his movies at himself.
Yeah, these are the movies he wants to make. These are the movies he wants to see. If they're his influences, these are the things he's said to himself. These films are important. They're good. They're masterful, whatever the superlative is. I want to create these movies in my own reflection, basically, what I've integrated as good and masterful and great.
Right, so he doesn't
so
sit
it,
there...
So it makes sense.
Right, so he doesn't sit there and say, oh, well, I'm going to make a movie the audience is going to like. What kind of movie would the audience like here? He says, I'm going to make a movie that I think is good. And when I sit down to watch it, I go, wow, it's awesome.
Exactly. And that's, frankly, when artists do that, and they are good artists, because believe me, there are some artists who do it and who are not good artists. But when they do it and they are good artists, that is superb art. That is what comes out as being the masterworks of all time, in my opinion. Not just in film, but in anything.
Right, it's a success. So let's look at his couple quotes about what success are, right? Everyone has a pretty great television now, and you'd better fucking give them a reason to get up off their sofa and go to the movies. I think this quote is his shorter one, but I think it speaks volumes more than a lot of them, because I think that's what he does. I mean, I go to the movies for a lot of movies, like even the recent X-Men Days of Future Past, and I was like, well, I could have just seen that on my 50-inch TV. Whereas with his, it's like, you know, when I saw Cloverfield, I had to see that in theaters. I went back to see it in theaters because it was one of those that had to be experienced. And I saw Man of Steel multiple times, because it had to be experienced on the big screen. And I think you're really missing out if you don't watch his movies on the big screen.
They were designed for that. I mean, it's like an artist who needed a huge canvas and instead just got a little tile. Like, you can't translate it that way.
Exactly. The one director I think of in particular who there is absolutely no reason under any circumstance to see on the big screen is like Woody Allen. His movies are so sort of naturalistic and poorly visually considered, not in the terms of directorially, but in terms of not translating it for a big screen with a large sound system, et cetera, that it's like, what is the point of going to pay $12?
Right, sort of similar like with Zach.
You're
Braff,
wasting
right?
this entire system. Yeah.
Right, like I wouldn't have wanted to see Garden State in theaters, and I don't want to see his new one in theaters. Or even the Veronica Mars movie that just came out. I just watched that on Amazon. I didn't bother to, you know, go see it in theaters, because why? It's not shot for theaters.
Exactly. This isn't to say that these movies are necessarily bad. I find some of Woody Allen good, but the point is that the theater system, this huge screen, the sound, the whole experience, has a certain set of characteristics, and many directors don't take those into consideration when they're making the film.
Right.
But I think
so
Snyder
again,
does.
Again, something we see with Snyder is he's very, very criteria and reality focused, where he's trying to actually achieve certain things in reality. He's not just saying, well, I'm going to make this kind of film. He's actually very focused on what is it actually going to take to make these things? What are the concretes I have to achieve?
Mm-hmm.
His other quote about success that's really revealing is, my personal success would be that people understand what I was trying to do. If the movie succeeds, it's that people understand the subtlety, that they're able to see past the conventions of what they think a movie is and go a tiny bit deeper.
So, the plot thickens.
Yeah, I have two reactions to this because of the plot thickening. One, I feel like, hey, Zack Snyder, I am giving you personal success by doing these podcasts because I'm proving I understand the subtlety. But on the other hand, so many people miss the subtlety that I wonder, does he not have any personal success?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's interesting. How many people would it take to understand your art for you to feel like it was successful?
Yeah, I think we're kind of missing the point a little bit by saying that. I think if we look at the movies themselves, I do think the movies show the subtlety and they're in there if people want to look for them. So I don't think it's necessarily, you know, people understanding them. I think it's that if people are looking, they're able to find it. And I just think a lot of people aren't looking.
Yeah, but I mean, it is an interesting question. I mean, if to not go back to Atlas Shrugged too much in this podcast, even though we're going to want to.
Well, we will in a second here.
The composer, what is the composer's name? Richard Haley.
Okay. I was going to say, I only know two composers, Michael Giacchino and Bear McCreary. But we're talking about a fictional character in Atlas Shrugged, Richard Haley.
Yeah, fictional composer, Richard Haley, who basically people ignore his music for a long time. And then basically what happens in Atlas Shrugged is there's sort of like a hipster movement around his music. She doesn't describe it this way, obviously, but that's what happens. People sort of get interested in it ironically.
Featuring
and it becomes
Allison Mack with her hipster boyfriend.
And it becomes a huge success overnight, and he gets very famous, but that's when he gives up writing music, right? Because people aren't truly getting it. So before that, when only a tiny fraction of people were getting it, but it wasn't popular, he was happy. But then the moment sort of everyone loved it, although no one got it, he stopped writing music.
Yeah, and I think Zack Snyder exists in an interesting space in that sense where he is popular and his movies make money, but I don't know how many people actually get it. But at the same time, they're not treated like Michael Bay movies. So there's sort of an interesting tension with the general conception of his movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And
absolutely.
Sort of what you're talking about with Richard Haley is that the culture's not there to understand his movie, his music, right? Well,
right.
I think it's the same thing with Zack Snyder where I'm going to read a couple quotes here which show that he makes movies that are so different from what's out there that I don't think people are attuned enough to be able to get it. So here's the first quote. It's a combination of pictures and design and acting and music can create an experience that is outside of the experience that you can actually have in reality, which gets to my motion picture philosophy. People are like, aren't you trying to make the movies as real as you can? I'm like, I'm really not. Reality, it's its own thing. And I'm not really into reality that much. I'm into this cinematic, stylized reality that can comment on reality. It's like the most beautiful parts of reality and the saddest parts, but it's none of this middle ground.
Wow.
Yeah,
I love
it. That's really, I mean, I think that's really only the reaction you can have is wow. And I think that's what makes him so much different from everyone out there. We have this obsession where people respond to a movie, well, that's not real. That's not what happened. You know, sometimes when you're creating the internal logic of a story, you're doing it for the theme. You're not doing it for the reality, like what would happen in reality.
But his point, you know, in that quote, the really thing I appreciate is his point that reality is its own thing, and he's not into reality that much. Now, clearly doesn't mean he's, you know, running out in the middle of streets and whatever. But his point being that why would you go watch a piece of art that is like depicting what you can see every day when the whole entire point of art is that you can create literally anything you want? Why would you choose to recreate the mundane, the common, the everyday? It seems completely backwards to do that.
Right, and it's very surprising he's the only one who has that perspective, but I think it speaks volumes that he is able to come to his perspective on his own. And I think, you know, we looked at his background a little bit. I think it's because he was allowed to bend the rules on his own. And because he was allowed to just kind of do whatever he wanted when he was young. Where he was just like, well, then I'm going to use this medium the way I want to. So because he was given the freedom, rather than being limited and told by people, well, this is the best, you know, do naturalism, I think that's how he derived to it. So I think we sort of see how his psychology and his experiences led to his philosophy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think we'll ever see Zack Snyder directing a reality show.
That would be quite an interesting reality show. So let's go to his other quote about romanticism in film. And this one is even
be
crazy.
Prepared to yell, all people who don't like Zack Snyder.
Yeah, this is your ammunition, people who don't like Zack Snyder. So we're giving this to you. You can have it. I've always been influenced by the human form, which we clearly see, right, in 300, Watchmen. Yeah. I'm a big fan of that Shakespeare quote. And the Shakespeare quote is, of course, saying that people are the, you know, they're beautiful and they're great with emotion, or they're great with reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
I tend to leave out the bad part of the Paragon of Animals quote because I have this sort of Ayn Rand aesthetic. It was always one of those quotes that inspired me. For whatever reason, I was always obsessed with the potential of humanity's physicality, especially since we grew up with such a non-physical philosophy. So when he says, especially since we grew up, he's talking about Christian Science, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting that he came from this very non-reality-centric philosophy, which is very much about, like, pray for everything you want and it will happen. But then he became such a, you know, a physical-based, reality-based filmmaker. Because I do think he's not just obsessed with the potential of human physicality. I think it's the potential of human physicality and how that works with human philosophy.
Definitely, philosophy as it pertains to physicality, and you can see that most, well, you can see it in pretty much all of his films, but I think most starkly in 300, where the bad guys are sort of monsters and deformed and depraved, and the good guys are the opposite. They're beautiful and they have these great physiques, and the whole
super
culture
buff.
Is just, yes, abs!
Yeah, and we'll talk about this a little more in the 300 podcast, but that has a lot to do with the fact that the novel it's based on is by someone who's a big Ayn Rand fan, Frank Miller.
Right. Indeed. But, I mean, the whole thing about him actually saying he has this sort of Ayn Rand aesthetic, that says, at least people who are really familiar with Ayn Rand's philosophy, a whole lot about his philosophy of filmmaking.
Right, so Ayn Rand is very much a philosophy for living on Earth, and she wrote a lot. She wrote the Romantic Manifesto, which is all about romanticism and why it's the best form of art, and she wrote about why naturalism was bad. And when she's talking about romanticism, she's talking about the ideal men. And if you look at all of Zack Snyder's movies, I mean, even in Dawn of the Dead, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, you have the ideal man. He just happened to have worked at Best Buy. Then you have, you know, 300, you have Leonidas. You have Watchmen, which there are ideal men in there, and that's why people hate it who love the book, because that's a major departure from the book. Then even in the Legends of the Guardian, he has the ideal owls. Then you look at Man of Steel. I mean, that's definitely about the ideal man and him defining what the Superman means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's been a huge theme in all of his work. But, I mean, even contained within that, the whole concept of romanticism for Ayn Rand, at least, is romantic. It contains in it the idea of romantic realism, which is the idea of not evading reality in your movies, but heightening it, sort of the best possible version of reality, or heightening it for a specific reason, that you're accentuating some principle, and you're not doing it as something grotesque or depraved.
Right, and that's really the surprising thing for me to have read that he said that, because I think I was aware of that, and I wanted to say he was aware of that, and to actually have him say that, because that's what he does in each of those movies. I mean, he heightens the physicality of the Spartans in 300 because it's all about fighting for your freedom. Even though there's this intense irony that they're not really free, he's still showing the freedom of the Spartans and the fighting for it and what it takes versus the people who are in chains under Xerxes. And if you look at all the other movies, he's heightening specific things in order to talk about, like you said, a specific principle.
Yes, very much so. It's what can you use visually to represent the principles and theme of the ideas you're talking about.
Right, so. And one final point about sort of the visual style in this sense, and you know, we'll talk about it throughout the series, is that's something that I see missing from so much. It's not just in film either, it's in writing in general, is the idea of, and this is, you know, really romanticism, this is what Ayn Rand was really good at too, it's concretizing what your theme is in actual things in the movie visually. And that's what Snyder does, not just with his characters and the way they look, but the camera movements, the audio, the use of color, all of it he thinks through concretely. What am I doing visually with this picture? As he says, it's a series of pictures. What am I doing with these pictures to concretize what the story is?
Absolutely, and that's why I love him.
So the other thing we have in the document down there is we have his 10 golden rules of filmmaking. Take a look at that, because that's pretty revealing too, if you think about it in light of the discussion we just had. But we're going to move on because, not surprisingly, if you're talking about romanticism and exaggerating life, his directorial debate was in horror, a genre that naturally invites romanticism. It also featured my favorite horror monster, zombies. Let's talk about Dawn of the Dead. Dawn of the Dead was Zack Snyder's first major movie. It was released in 2004. Of course, he was originally going to write the SWAT adaptation, or direct the SWAT adaptation in 2002, but Universal decided to end that deal because they were too worried about his gritty, violent approach to visual style. Which, of course, then it makes sense he would do a zombie movie, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing I want to note before we go into this discussion a little bit is he didn't actually write this movie. This movie was written by James Gunn, who is, of course, writing and directing the Guardians of the Galaxy movie that comes out this summer. But even then, you can see James Gunn seems to sort of prefer a romanticist style as well, right? I mean, from mm-hmm. the trailers, it certainly looks like that, doesn't it, for Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yeah, definitely.
So you can kind of...
That whole talking raccoon bullshit.
Well, I mean, that is based on the comic, but even just the way he, you know... It's not bullshit. I think a talking raccoon is awesome. The way he seemed to have directed it seems like it's almost, there's sort of parallels to Snyder in there. But I do think it sort of worked out well for Snyder that he directed a Gunn script to start with. And Gunn didn't completely do all of it. There were two uncredited people who came in and helped afterwards. So I think that's important to note that Snyder didn't write it. Let's talk about it a little bit. What do you guys want to start with? Do you want to start with plot, style, or theme?
Toughies. Let's start with plot.
Plot? Okay.
Yeah.
What do you guys have to say about the plot?
Zombies.
That's it? That's all you have to say about the plot?
So the plot is basically, it begins in a typical zombie fashion, right? Where there's sort of an outbreak and no one knows what's going on, and there's people who have to survive, and they come together to try to survive in one central location, and then they have to make the decision about whether or not this is something they want to maintain or if they want something more than this.
Right, and actually the interesting thing you talk about at the beginning is the beginning and end, and when I say the end, I mean over the credits, were not originally in the script. He and the producer decided later to add the beginning in the hospital with Sarah Polley and, you know, people saying that that's the first zombie when they bring the people in on the gurney, that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. which, I mean, doesn't really make any sense because somebody had to bite him and, like, there was obviously already mayhem. But they did that to sort of give a broader perspective. So you even see how a director, even if he doesn't write the script, kind of does write the script and has that influence.
I thought it was interesting that he brought up in the commentary that the beginning is the first thing they shot, whereas usually you would shoot the ending first.
Yeah, the movie was shot in a highly linear order, which is very atypical for movies.
That's interesting. I mean, that goes back to, he talks in one of his quotes, I forget, about storyboarding and how important that is to him personally and figuring out sort of exactly the type of shots you want to do. And maybe really early on, he super heavily relied on that as a director, but I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, we can move into style a little bit then. That's something I did definitely notice is there were a lot of shots where you could tell he told everyone to stand in specific places and the blocking was very specific so he could get his picture in the series of pictures. There was one when they were in the mall food court and I saw everybody standing there and because I was paying attention to it, I noticed a lot more that this was a much, you know, I appreciated much more how visually stylized it was and how he wasn't just letting people, the actors, act naturally. He was making sure they were where they were supposed to be for his shot.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that always impressed me with Snyder, but that you can sort of see even in an enhanced way in this film, is that he uses shots that aren't common for the eye to see. And what I mean by that is even in movies that are like action movies and such, they tend to have shots that are sort of, you know, sort of mid-tight frame, and it'd be as if you were like an onlooker looking at the action going on. Not the case for Zack Snyder. There were so many huge juxtapositions of visuals in this where he would have an insane close-up of a doorknob and their hand, for instance. And then the next shot is an insane aerial shot from above where you can sort of like barely see the characters, but you can sort of see the overall visual going on. Back to intense close-ups of faces and whatnot. And he's very big on this idea of using the medium to its extremes, to its max, to get the highest sort of visual potential out of it versus just sort of, well, this is what it would look like if you were standing next to the character.
Yeah, and he did that a couple of times with the wide shots. Like, the two I really remember are, and he did pullouts for both of them. It was at the beginning with the neighborhood Sarah Polley's character lived in, where he pulled it out twice. You know, it was like, tch, tch, in order to show just how destroyed the world was. And then he did it again on when they were on the roof of the mall. He went, tch, tch, the two pullouts, to just show how many zombies there were and how crowded around the mall they were. And if he didn't show that, you wouldn't get a sense of just how crazy the world had become and how trapped they are in this mall.
And he actually did the first pullout at the beginning when she was driving home to her little suburban neighborhood to show that the world was calm and everything was structured in this little suburban area. And then all of a sudden, that juxtaposition to everything is destroyed and to they're screwed and stuck in a mall.
And, you know, we said we were starting with plot and then we went to style, but in this way the style plays into the plot because he's establishing so much visually with the plot and he's establishing, like Hannah just said, oh, it's calm and everything's fine. And then he progresses the story to show, oh, it's crazy and they're trapped here in the mall.
Mm-hmm.
Something I didn't even think of that I'm thinking about now is when they show Andy in the gun shop and he gets bit, you don't even really see him get bit. It's such a wide shot of watching the dog go in the doggy door and then the zombies go at the doggy door. So, mm-hmm. you know, maybe that's considered a mark against him because visually you don't see what happens, but you don't need to because what they're establishing is you're far away from it like the people on the roof are. So he's giving you the perspective on the people of the roof. And it's really interesting that he did that. And now that you're saying that, that really clicked in my head.
Yeah, it's very interesting. But, I mean, there are other shots in it that sort of support what I was talking about, this whole idea of the shots that are different from what you would see as a spectator. One of them is early on when she's leaving her house. And so the first there are like extreme close-ups of her on like the gear shift, for instance. And then it goes to the back of her car, almost shot from like almost on top of the trunk, which is not something you really ever see as a spectator of any sort. And the car turning and her missing neighbors and whatnot. It's a very interesting choice for that.
During the commentary, he actually said that he was behind her car. They were like on a flatbed truck, and he had like the camera.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's pretty typical to have the director follow like that. But he was talking about it was a very unique rig they had to do that shot. So you can sort of see the his ingenuity. I mean, there's some talk about like J.J. Abrams has that ingenuity too with stuff, where especially with the Lost first episode, with the way they shot the whole opening with Jack, it was very, you know, J.J. Abrams was like, we're going to do this, and they figured out how to make it work. And I think what you're talking about here with Snyder, that's an example of that as well.
And I want to quickly compare this to another famous director, because there's someone else, Darren Aronofsky, in the film Black Swan, makes a directorial choice where he shows the back of Natalie Portman's head for a long period of time. Now, I want to contrast these, because the shot with the head and Aronofsky, you get no other visual information from the shot. It's basically just a full shot of the back of her head, and you can tell she's moving, but it's all blurred, and you can't see anything else. Versus the shot with Zack Snyder, who was behind the car, close enough that you felt like you were like sitting on the back, on the trunk, but you could see all of the action that was going on the sides of it, and sort of showing the things that she's trying to avoid, which includes zombies, burning things, neighbors who are alive but trying to get out. And it was giving you a lot of visual information simultaneously. And I think that's a huge contrast. And for whatever reason, Aronofsky gets credit for showing the back of a woman's head for 10 minutes, and Snyder sort of gets sneered at for these kind of things. But
well, it's the naturalism thing. As you said, Snyder's trying to show perspectives that you normally wouldn't get in reality. You wouldn't be behind the car like that, seeing all of this. Whereas looking at the back of someone's head and not really know what's going on, that is something that could happen in reality. You could be looking at the back of someone's head, and if you are, you don't really know what's going on. So I think it has to do with the naturalism versus romanticism debate and difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to throw Aronofsky under the bus for a second, just any chance I get.
No, I'm okay with that. I mean, Black Swan churned my stomach.
Yeah, awful.
So, style, the other thing I really noticed about the style, and this is something I think is super important because it's subtle, but I think this is what he talks about with the differences. He has a subtlety that he wants people to pay attention to. I talked about this with the music videos. It wasn't as much in the commercials. It's the color. There was a slight green tinge to this entire movie, especially when they were in the mall. I don't know if you picked that up at all, Daniel.
Probably a little harder. I was watching it on a computer monitor versus a really high def TV. So, I mean, the color looked saturated, but I couldn't tell you what color it was.
Hannah, I know you noticed that.
Yeah, it was pretty prevalent throughout the whole movie, that green tinge. I think it was to just emphasize that the world was falling apart and it, like, the sickness is spreading because it was green.
How does that change things, though, to have the whole movie saturated a certain color?
It was very stylized in that, you know, like hospital lights kind of have that tinge when you're in the room. So it's like you're in this prism of, oh, things aren't okay. And the whole movie, like, things were never okay.
And I think that's exactly the way to put it, is the hospital, because it started out in the hospital. And remember, like we said, that wasn't originally the beginning of the movie and they added it. And it starts out with the green in the hospital, and that continues throughout, especially in the mall. So there's a visual parallel drawn there between the hospital and the mall. And they're basically all, the point is they're all dying. And they're all trying to fight against that dying in the same sense of what's going on in a hospital.
To only add to what Hannah said, the idea of having the tone, you know, showing that something is wrong, it's both something that we don't really experience in reality, but also something that occasionally happens in emergency situations. So you may not be familiar with this, but living in the Midwest, for instance, when we know there's going to be a really bad storm, the sky turns a specific type of sort of sickish greenish yellow, and that's from various, you know, sun and clouds and whatever, but that almost always indicates that there's going to be a tornado, for instance. And so you start to associate that kind of experience with danger, for instance. And I think that's what Snyder is trying to set up, that this is, something is off about this world, right? Something is sick or wrong or dangerous about this world.
Right. In the Northeast, it isn't really the color, it's the calmness before like a hurricane or something, or before a snowstorm, right? I mean, even a snowstorm though, I mean, that blankets everything white. So knowing Snyder grew up in the Northeast, I think that probably has an influence on it too. So I think that that's a very good point, Daniel. But let's go back to the plot a little bit, because I want to kind of talk about the ending. Because the original ending was just Sarah Polley on the boat in the water, and that was where it cut out. And the stuff over the credits came later. So what I want to talk about is what happened to CJ and what happened to Best Buy Guy. Is this an example of Snyder celebrating self-sacrifice? Because you could argue the same thing about 300, and we'll have to talk about that when we talk about 300.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It depends on exactly what we're talking about in terms of self-sacrifice. So for instance, at the end of this film, the guy, I can't think of his name. Best Buy guy.
Michael, right?
Michael. Okay. Sure, Mikey. He's been bitten. Like, he knows he's going to die. There's no way to get around that. And it's going to be sort of quickly. Like, it's not going to be dead over 20 years, for instance. And if he really cares about the people he's sort of sending off on the boat, including the main woman, whose name I also don't remember, if he really cares about her, then leaving himself there so that he knows he can't hurt her when he turns into a zombie is not a sacrifice. It's not a matter of giving up a greater value for a lesser value. It's a matter of making sure that his higher value, this girl, is safe over the lower value at the moment, which is his life for the next 5 minutes or however long it's going to take.
That was the interesting thing, is he didn't say like, I don't want to go, or he wasn't like, I'm going to stay here to protect you. He just said, I can't go. That was what he said to her.
Right.
He looked at her and he said, I can't go. So the fact that I think what was heroic about it, and I think Snyder was trying to get us to acknowledge this as well, is he just accepted reality. What made his character was the hero throughout the entire movie, right? And that's why it was funny when Mekhi Phifer said to him, what did you do in the real world? He's like, I sold TVs at Best Buy. But he was the one who was the most reality centric in the entire movie, right? Ving Rhames' character wanted to not acknowledge that his brother was dead. Mekhi Phifer didn't want to acknowledge that his wife was dead and he had a zombie baby. You know, all of these other characters did things that ignored reality, and that's what led to their deaths. But this guy, he always accepted reality and lived in line with it, and that's why he was able to be successful, and they were all able to be successful on any level. Another character was the girl with the fucking dog. Like, she was so not reality-centric at all. And ultimately, he stayed reality-centric at the end, and he got the Zack Snyder physicality hero shot, right? That wide shot of him on the dock with the smoke behind him. Like, the way the smoke looked, it was just, to me, it was beautiful. And that, to me, that's an example of just the how beautiful Snyder's directing is.
Yeah, absolutely. So I definitely don't think it was a sacrifice in the proper understanding of the concept of sacrifice. It might be colloquially sacrifice, but that's incorrect.
What about CJ?
Which one? Who? What the
CJ
who?
CJ was the one who, he was the head security guard, and he didn't want to let anyone in. And then at the end, he ended up giving up his life by blowing up the propane. You also might remember him from House of Cards.
Yeah, that's where I saw him. Very different characters. Wow. Dirty Stash Guy, yeah.
Yes.
He's a little harder, because it was harder to decipher his motivations throughout the thing. Early on, he really just wanted power, it seemed like. And that was his whole thing, was, I want to be able to be in charge, boss people around, have my vision of the world enacted now that the world has gone to hell. And then after his little stint in prison, he seemed to have some sort of change, but that was one of my bigger critiques of the film, is that it wasn't made clear why he changed or in what capacity he changed. It just, he changed.
Yeah, and that's why I'm saying it's sort of conventional self-sacrifice in that he redeemed himself, right? In the beginning, he was like the self-serving asshole who only wanted power. And then at the end, he gave his life for everyone by blowing up the propane tank.
I think he had the change when he realized when the TVs went dead and he was like, tell me something I don't know, like about the zombies or about how they, you're supposed to kill them or how they came back. But when the next day happened where all the TVs went to static, he was asked, so what's the news? And he said, there is no news. So he had to acknowledge reality.
Maybe. I think the change probably came when he was forced to go with Michael into the garage to try and turn the generator on. Because remember there was that whole give and take scene where we still weren't sure who was in charge. And Michael was like, do you really think I brought you down here just to tell me where it was? Not to come with me? And then he made him come with him. And then from that point on, they seemed to sort of be bonded. And CJ was always fighting for them and helping them.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, because his buddy died down there by legless zombie.
Right. So maybe that's what it is he was forced to acknowledge the reality of it because he actually had to deal with it. Whereas before he was in his insulated mall and he thought he was protected. But I think this whole discussion points to what Dan's saying in that, it wasn't very clear. And I think that's probably the weakest part of the movie. And once again, I think it's important to note that Snyder didn't write this one, that I don't think a lot of the character development was well defined. I think beyond Michael, which may have had a lot to do with the acting or Zack Snyder's directing, I don't think a lot of the character motivation was very clear.
Yeah, indeed. But I don't know. I mean, I think overall, the two main characters, the male and the female, Michael and Herschel, I think those were integrated well into the plot and the theme. And then the others were sort of less integrated, but...
What would you say the theme was?
Oh no, you're not going to play that trick with me.
Because it's kind of hard to define the theme of this movie, right?
Right, and you're going to be the theme expert, and I'm going to say something, and you're going to be like, no way, it's totally this. I'm going to be like, fuck, it was. So no, I'm not playing the game.
I mean, I think if anything, the theme of this movie is just accepting the reality of what's going on because of what we already discussed with the Michael plot. And even with Sarah Pauly's character, she was in denial at the beginning because of what happened to her husband and everything. And it was only the characters who were able to accept what was going on that were able to have any sort of modicum of success. And then if we take the original ending as them being on the boat, and that's a more hopeful ending, then I do think we have to say it's just acknowledging the reality of what's going on. You know, CJ, like I said, eventually sort of just accepted it. And, you know, all the characters that fucked up stuff happened to, like, Mekhi Phifer. I think Mekhi Phifer's kind of the foil to Michael's character, right? Mm-hmm. Where he didn't want to accept the reality, and because of that, he ended up dying and getting killed and killing that old woman. So I think all the tragedy happened where people didn't want to accept what was going on, whereas Michael's character did, and Sarah Pauly's character did.
I mean, it's interesting, because when they started to accept, for instance, they had to sort of live in the mall... Then you have the whole montage of them sort of like building a life and being kind of happy. And so, I don't know. I mean, I think that's probably the theme, but it may not have been parsed out exactly the way I would have done it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because then you have the whole thing at the end.
What do you mean the thing at the end?
Well, the thing at the end where they get on the boat and try to survive. And then if that's the real ending, okay, that sort of still fits in with the theme, but we know that that's not the full visuals that you get. You get the visuals over the credits.
Yeah, which... we'll talk about that in a second, right? So I do think this one is, I think of all of, and this will transition nicely into our final question, I do think out of all of Snyder's movies, this is the one with the most muddled theme.
Yeah.
It's not as clear, and I think partially that's due to it being based on a Romero film. And being based on something that already existed. And I think that partially it's due to somebody else writing the script and him not being as involved. I mean, I know like he didn't write Man of Steel, but if you look at Man of Steel, he had a huge influence on that. And a lot of what Goyer does in his other work lines up with what Snyder does anyway. And, you know, even in the new Dawn of Justice that's going to come out, Snyder didn't write the script, but he wrote the story. So I just think he didn't have as much influence here as he does on his later work.
Yeah.
So
indeed.
The question then is, how much do we like this movie? Now, since this is the first one, we can't rank it in relation to the others. As we go, we'll rank and we'll say, oh, well, we slot this in between all these other films. But right now, since this is the first one, let's just say how much we liked it. I mean, you don't have to do 1 to 10 or anything, but just give an idea of how much you guys liked this movie.
Well, I mean, I liked the movie in the sense that it was one of the better zombie movies I've seen, and we'll compare it in Yahoo Answers later to another one. But it was entertaining. It was fast-paced. It sort of didn't... It had explanation, but it integrated the explanation into the storyline. So, like, you got explanation from TV out of the mall or from rumor or whatever it is, and it didn't sort of stop to give you exposition, per se. You know, the whole ending, whatever, I didn't particularly care for, and I don't know. The one thing I really didn't like was ultimately character development, but, and the reason I say that is primarily because of the main woman, and primarily because she went from sort of having her boyfriend murdered in front of her to being okay with all the people at the mall in basically no time whatsoever. So that threw me off for the entire movie, basically. So, I mean, it was okay. It was okay for me.
They did have a shot of her when she was getting those shoes and the medicine kit that she took time to sit down and just grieve about what was happening.
Yeah, it was very similar to when Kate took the shoes off the dead body in the pilot of Lost, right? And when she took the shoes out of the Lost and Found in the security guard's office. It was very similar, like, she's realizing that she's dealing with the sort of reality here of I'm stuck here and I have to make do with what I have.
Yeah. And I don't want, you know, I don't want reality where she, you know, curls up in a fetal position and has to have antidepressants and psychology sessions for 6 months. But it just seemed very sudden, and it didn't seem like she went through what you would have even gone through in a stylized world. But that was for me. I mean, I thought overall the movie was okay. Best part of it was, of course, the directing.
Hannah?
Well, I really enjoyed this zombie movie. I think it was, I had seen probably 3 zombie movies before this one, but this one just brought it home that it was a scenario that could occur. You know, just living in a suburban neighborhood and then the outbreak happening and then seeing the world just crumble around people trying to survive and the struggle of surviving. I guess they also had like emotionally as well as just physical survival. So I really enjoyed it. It's pretty up there for me as far as zombie films go.
Yeah, as far as zombie films go, it's pretty high up there for me. I thought it was good, not great. The thing that really stuck out to me about it is I think visually it really influenced The Walking Dead. Now, I do think The Walking Dead is more naturalistic than it is romantic, but I do think the way they portrayed it on such a, like you were saying, Daniel, about showing the things you wouldn't normally see and the reactions of people and really focusing on that, I think you can actually see a lot of the influence this movie has on that series.
Yeah, I agree with you. I kept thinking throughout that I was like, oh, yeah, I've sort of seen something like this in The Walking Dead. And then I had to remember The Walking Dead came way after this.
Yeah.
Right. And having watched this again now after having watched all of The Walking Dead, I can really see that influence. So I appreciate this. Like I said, I think it's good. It's not great. But I think it's very good for a debut film is the important thing here. Is I would not have known this was a debut film unless somebody told me it was.
Right, very good in that regard. Very good.
So everything that is made confuses people, and no journey into the midside is complete without an attempt to clear up that confusion. So it's time for a Snyder-centric Yahoo Answers answer.
Just another answer, I won't begin. And just another question. Just another answer, I won't begin.
For this week's Yahoo Answers Answers, we're going to do a few questions about Zack Snyder generally, and then we're going to do a couple about Dawn of the Dead in specific. And we'll see this as we move forward with the Zack Snyder podcast. Yes, Drew, Yahoo Answers Answers will be staying for the Snyder series. So you can take a, let out your deep breath that you were
holding. Whew, thank God.
I know Daniel's very happy about it. First question. You know the director, Zack Snyder, parentheses 300?
Yes.
Yeah, we've heard something about him. Well, he started out as a great commercial director. Really? We had no idea. That's revelatory. How do you become a great one? What do I have to study in college for it?
Well, you could study what Zack Snyder studied.
Yeah, go to the London Heatherly School and then go to the School of Design in Pasadena. I want to know, is this saying, how do you become a great commercial director or just a great director?
Or a great one in general.
It's funny, this question was written by Michael Bay.
I did the same thing as him, but I don't know.
So I think a more serious answer is that you do have to study some technical elements of filmmaking, whether you want to study editing or animation or, you know, photography, whatever it is, you do have to know some technical element. But then I think the other answer is simply you have to immerse yourself in your craft. You have to learn everything about it. You have to have ideas about it and what to do right and wrong. And you want to have this passion for making something that's yours and making it different from other people.
Yeah, I mean, study film, as you were saying, Daniel, but the other thing I would add is just study life, because you have to have something to say about it, and as you were pointing out about Snyder, you have to know what you want to show. And if you're going to show the hand close on the doorknob to the wide shot, you have to have an awareness of what you're showing about life to do that. So it's not just about being technically proficient in the field. If you're going to be an artist, it's a selective recreation of reality, right? That's the definition. Mm-hmm. You need to know what you're recreating and why you're recreating it.
Yeah. Have ideas. Have strong convictions about what you're doing. Don't be wishy-washy. Have something that you feel passionate about. Yeah.
And stick with it.
Yeah.
And since you were asking, Daniel, about, you were always wondering what the answers were, I included them this week. So,
oh, yeah.
The best answer, the only answer, by Sabrina C., was IDK go to number 2 college and ask. To which
yeah.
the asker then replied, 4 out of 5. So they gave that comment 4 out of 5 stars. Yeah, .. Y, letter Y. Worry now, I'll do that. So the
he hadn't thought of that.
The answer he took away was 1, he hadn't thought of that, and 2, he's just not going to think about it. So if you've learned anything from this podcast, learn what you want to do as soon as possible and just commit to it. That's what we see about so many great people, right? Snyder figuring out at age 11 that he wanted to do this. No, worry about it now, not because you're worried, but it's because it's what you want to do. Find out what you want to do and do it. If you want to be a great film director, just do it.
Yeah.
Sponsored by Nike.
We wish.
Next question. Which comic movie should or you think Zack Snyder do next? So I'm assuming this person doesn't speak English. This is the more details. Now that he did 300 and Watchmen, if you were a fan of his previous films, which comic do you want him to tackle next? If you don't like his films, don't judge, JK.
At first I thought they meant like comedic movie, like we want him to direct the Dumb and Dumber sequel or something. But I got it now.
So which do you think? Do you guys have an answer? Which comic would you like to see him direct next?
It's interesting. I actually, when I was watching Days of Future Past, X-Men recently, I thought it'd be really cool to see a Zack Snyder reboot of the X-Men series.
Mm-hmm. Or even just a version of Days of Future Past where he would take that cool concept of the Sentinels and he, you know, the Mystique Sentinels, And can you imagine what the opening scene would have been if he had directed it rather than Singer?
Right. Not goofy and overacted and gimmicky?
Right, and way too small scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would have been tremendous. But I would love to see him do the X-Men in the future, maybe a reboot of that series. But
I don't think that can
that,
happen,
I don't
though.
Know.
I don't think he can ever jump from DC to Marvel now. I think that line's been drawn in the sand.
Oh, no. Give it 5 years. No one will care.
But 5 years is when Justice League is going to be released.
Oh, whatever. Give it 15 years. Be fine. But other than that, I don't know. Hannah?
I think that he needs to do something similar to Legend of the Guardians with the owls, but for Darkwing Duck.
That would be really interesting, actually. I hadn't even thought of that, but like and it can have his sort of irony that he carries with it, you know, sort of like a satire of Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy and doing a Duck Knight trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
That could work really well, actually. I hadn't thought of that. Giving sort of a gritty realism to Darkwing Duck.
The Duck Knight. Wow.
You've never heard that before?
No.
Oh, well, you know how there's the Dark Knight Returns? There's a comic for Darkwing Duck called The Duck Knight Returns.
All right, then.
All right, and my answer to this question, there's been a rumored movie that's supposed to have happened for a long time of the graphic novel series Why the Last Man. I think he could do a really good job of that. I think it's similar enough to a zombie movie, but different enough that he could do it. And I also think he would move it away from the naturalism somebody would naturally take it to and towards romanticism, in the sense that the thing I love about the comic is it shows realistically, but a heightened reality, what would happen if there was only one man left on Earth. Like, all the different factions are fighting for him. There's an Amazonian women tribe. There's, you know, Israel is very strong because all their women are forced to fight in the military. And rather, you know, wasting it on the internal politics and the actual small squabbles that would happen, there are just these large movements within the comic of all these different groups fighting. And I think he'd be able to portray that really well visually, rather than just, you know, the sort of naturalistic, slow plodding pace I think a lot of people would take, like The Road was.
Interesting.
The Road was so depressing. It was so depressing.
Yeah. Hey, one other quick thought I had, actually, about what Zack Snyder could do next is, so many people have brought him up for, like, Atlas Shrugged, which would be interesting.
Wait, who else has brought him up for Atlas Shrugged?
Well, mainly you and me, but...
Yeah, I was gonna say, that was my whole pitch to the people who were doing Atlas Shrugged. I wrote this whole, treatment for it, and I gave it to them, and I was like, this should be done in Zack Snyder's style. And they were like, no. And my favorite was with the documentary director who was like, you want to turn this into like a pulpy type movie? And I was like, well, yeah, that's exactly what it should be. And he said right, that if it was a bad thing, I was like, you just don't get it.
It's kind of what Ayn Rand would have really wanted. But along those same veins, why not Anthem? Anthem is a story that's ripe for a sort of dystopian, really hyper-stylized visual. And it's public domain, so you wouldn't have to pay anyone for the script.
Yeah, I could see that. That would work really well. So let's take a look at some of the answers here, right? The one other answer before we do the best answer was NEDM 404. So that, you know, that's an internet handle, not even Doom Music 404 error. Does anyone know the NEDM meme?
No.
Hannah's just shaking her head. It was from YTMND, You're the Man Now, Dog. And NEDM wants to know, didn't he also do Sin City and The Spirit? No, he didn't. Mm-hmm. But once again, this is the overlap with Frank Miller, right? Robert Rodriguez did the original Sin City, but it's in Frank Miller's style, which once again has the same influences that Snyder has. But I think it's important that we name check Rodriguez, because I think Rodriguez is another filmmaker who doesn't try to recreate reality, and he sort of does his own thing. I'm not sure I'd quite call it romanticism, but I do like his films because he doesn't try to recreate reality.
Yeah.
And then The Spirit was just sort of done in the same style of Sin City and 300 to try and capitalize on that, right? It wasn't, I don't even know who directed it. I'll always remember it for Stana Katic's absurd performance. And every time I watch Castle, I always remember that. So, and then the best answer, I won't read the whole thing. I'll just read the first paragraph because it's relevant to what we were talking about. And remember, this is from 5 years ago. John H. said, I'm interested in what his version of The Dark Knight Returns would look like. I know he has expressed interest. The only problem is how it would be received in the midst of Chris Nolan's Batman franchise. Well, John H., 5 years later, you're going to see that. Because we know that at Comic-Con, he had the actor from The Dark, from Man of Steel read the quote from The Dark Knight Returns, and that's going to have a huge influence on Dawn of Justice. So you're getting your wish.
Woo.
Which also, The Dark Knight Returns was written by Frank Miller. Next question. Poll. Zack Snyder or Christopher Nolan? All the answers here are either Christopher Nolan or Zack Snyder. Interestingly, the best answer was considered to be Zack Snyder, which we're not going to disagree with. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not going to disagree with.
Different. Different. I mean, I like them both. I like a lot of what Nolan has done. But I prefer the more stylized nature of Snyder in film. Nolan did a really good job with the Batman series, but it was a little more, I don't want to even say naturalistic, but maybe just a little grittier than, I don't know, I would have liked ultimately, but.
Yeah, I mean, Watchmen wasn't even really as gritty as the Batman series was, right?
Right. Yeah, it was stylized violence versus sort of violence. So, Snyder, 2016.
Hannah, what do you think? Zack Snyder or Christopher Nolan?
Snyder.
Do you have reasoning for that? Or did you just want to fit in?
Oh, I get
He's
laid.
Cuter.
I'm just saying it to get laid.
By Zack Snyder because he's cuter and not British? Could we argue that Christopher Nolan is the Zack Snyder of Britain?
Oh my god.
Could we?
I don't know. No, Daniel, I agree with what you were saying with the assessment. I love Nolan's movies, but they're just not as stylized. Like, if you look at a movie like The Prestige, which I think is brilliant, it's just not as stylized, right? He does sort of take all the colors out of it, but everything that he does it seems more straightforward. And then the other thing is, he seems to have a darker view of humanity than Snyder does. Snyder celebrates humanity more, where if you look at, like, the ending of The Prestige, it's a very negative, dark ending.
Mm-hmm.
Although I say that with the caveat that The Dark Knight Rises, I thought, was very good in the celebration of humanity. So I think it's more the stylization, and just Snyder more openly celebrates humanity.
Yeah.
Next question. At the end of the movie Dawn of the Dead, did the people survive? I wanted to know because at the end, they went to an island and they see a lot of the dead running toward them and then everything went blank. Well, of course, as we were saying, this wasn't in the original script. This was something that Snyder and the producer added because when they did it with the test audience didn't respond well to the boat ending because they wanted to know what happened to people.
Of course.
So they must have all hated Inception.
Well, okay, I'm glad you made this parallel, right? Because that's where I was going to go with it, is that's the point, right? Just like at the end of Inception, the point isn't did it fall or did it not fall. The point at the end of Dawn of the Dead is did they survive, did they not survive? The point is you're not supposed to know because the lesson is, ironically, accepting reality in both of them, right? So the point of Inception was it didn't matter to him anymore if he was in the Inception world or he was in his real life. It was just, this is the situation I'm in. I'm just going to embrace it. Likewise, at the end of Dawn of the Dead, they just accepted the situation they were in, and that was the end of it. The world had changed. They had adapted to it. The end.
I mean, I think from the credits, you have to assume that they died.
Yeah, and that was why, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the island thing.
Right. Stupid islands messing up everything. But
can we blame this one on Lindelof somehow?
He snuck into the editing room. I think they died, and that's a bleak view of the world, but I think maybe in context of the story, it made more sense for them to die than to survive.
Right, and that's all ultimately the problem with most zombie films.
Right.
Right? And actually, it just reminded me of something with CJ's plot, something we forgot to talk about, so I'm going to go back to that. Most zombie films are all about, we can't handle the zombie outbreak. And I don't know, I tend more towards what CJ said, where he was watching, he goes, ah, America always finds a way to take care of its shit. Like, I have to believe humanity would find a way to deal with it. Like, I understand these zombies are menacing, but are you really telling me we're too incompetent as a species to handle a zombie outbreak? But for CJ's plot, I think there is the self-reliance in there, where he learned that he was waiting for someone else to take care of it, but then he learned there was no one else to take care of it. He had to take care of it himself. So I think maybe that's more CJ's motivations.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a good point.
Next question. Is Dawn of the Dead better than 28 Days Later? As a zombie film, I can't stand 28 Days Later, but many people continue to maintain that it is the best zombie movie ever made. So which do you prefer? Now, I think the important thing to say here is 28 Days Later came out in 2002, and Dawn of the Dead came out in 2004, and some people want to attribute the fast zombies to Snyder and say he came up with them. He didn't. The rage virus came first in 28 Days Later. So with that in mind, which do you like better?
I mean, I still prefer Dawn of the Dead. 28 Days Later, I only saw it once. I saw it in theaters, and I remember being bored by it to the point where I was sort of just like leaning on my headrest. From what I remember, it's like they pinpoint it to like a virus, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a virus from monkeys.
Yeah.
That Peter
so
tried to release to free.
So look, that kind of thing already turns me off in the sense that I'm more interested in what happens after the zombie apocalypse happens to the humans than learning about the backstory of the apocalypse itself. So I think Snyder did that better, and Dawn of the Dead in general did that better. Hmm. Maybe it's just me.
I agree with you about 28 Days Later that it was a little bit, it was rather slow. Because of how highly stylized it was, they made, I forgot who was the director.
Danny Boyle.
He made it like really artsy. There were a lot of artsy shots of like the countryside, of the Ferris wheel, of like just everything was rather artsy. There wasn't a lot of like motivational things like, oh, he has to do this in order to like get to this place or anything. It was just like, oh, all of this stuff is just happening. Great. Whereas Dawn of the Dead, everybody had their motives and they knew what they had to do, or they didn't know what they had to do, but they were trying to figure stuff out.
Right.
Yeah, might you say that there's a difference between like a zombie driven film versus a character driven zombie film?
Correct.
Right, yeah. And a lot of these we'll see they're paralleled in the answers that are put in here, right? So, from Chansey, I saw the 1978 version of Dawn of the Dead, and it was very good. Problem for me is that by today's standards, the makeup and effects seem a bit cheesy, which can really detract from a horror film. I didn't see the 2004 remake. I know it got pretty good reviews, though. I do think 28 Days Later was a great film, but I wouldn't consider it in the same category as Dawn of the Dead at all. While zombie like a phenomenon is central to the storyline, it is hardly a zombie film. And that's what you guys are saying.
Mm-hmm.
And then Shorty Diddy 03 said, I don't get why people say 28 Days Later is a zombie film, which to me it's not. Female Lord of the Rings fan. I love how this person has to say they're a female Lord of the Rings fan. Dawn of the Dead. And then the best answer by Matt, and it was the Asker's choice for best answer, said, 28 Days Later was a terrible movie. The ending wasn't even zombie-related or realistic. The guy went Rambo on the people there, which would never happen. Then the final ending, when they hit the fence, it was total garbage, if you ask me. Dawn of the Dead was good, not great, but still a ton better than 28 Days Later. In Dawn of the Dead, you had people with no gun experience knocking off headshots left and right, which is horribly unrealistic. Again, we see this needing things portrayed exactly as it would be in reality, right? The reason they're showing them shooting is because it's romanticized. It's saying, like, oh, cool, this is people fighting a zombie apocalypse. You don't want them to just, realistically, if people are have that many zombies against them that can run that fast and they have a gun, they're probably going to die, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the movie
short
just,
movie.
Right, very short movie. So the movie just ends. I do agree with the general gist of the comment, though. The thing I'll always remember about 28 Days Later was just, to me, it was the tone and the atmosphere. I thought they did very well. I've been creeped out by very few movies, but that movie just really, really creeped me out. Just the way it felt. Not the zombies, but just the feeling, the sort of the desolate depression of it. But overall, I think I'm more entertained by Dawn of the Dead than I was 28 Days Later.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
All right, so we've talked about a lot here today. This has been a very involved podcast about Zack Snyder. So let's end with the question we always end with. What did we learn today? Daniel, we're going to start with you.
Well, I learned that Star Wars gave us lightsabers, and Star Wars gave us Ewoks, and now Star Wars has given us Zack Snyder. Thank you, Star Wars.
God damn it, I can't even argue with this. It's like not even fair.
I knew my day would come.
What did you learn, Hannah?
I have a lot more respect for Zack Snyder and his cinematic art than I did before.
And I learned from Daniel part of Snyder's style that I wasn't really picking up before. And it's the different perspectives that aren't really normal to reality. So I was picking up a lot of the music. I was picking up a lot of the color saturation. I wasn't picking up the portraying events from different, well, I wasn't explicitly picking up the portraying events from a non-natural human perspective. So when I watch Snyder's films from now on, I'm going to pay attention to that a lot more. And through the rest of the series, I'm going to pay attention to that a lot more. I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I hoped you learned something about Zack Snyder and why we love him. This concludes your journey into the midside. Good luck out there this week, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.